Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Tom McCarthy, whose most recent novel is Sea. Earlier novel is Remainder. Sea has been shortlisted for the Booker Prize this year. Tom McCarthy is also known in the art world for the International Necronautical Society, which we are going to talk about at one point or another. After reading the book and doing my research on the book, what I'm getting is that there's a lot of philosophical conceptualism behind it. I'm hearing postmodern, neo-modern, post-realist, post-humanist, post-structuralist. Poor me, I'm thinking I'm reading a novel. From your perspective, Tom McCarthy, when you're writing a novel like this, A Remainder, are you thinking in those terms, or are you just thinking, hey, this is another novel?
The latter. I guess I've just been reading slightly different novels from the type that kind of tend to dominate mainstream publishing at the moment. I mean, I thought Sea and Remainder before it were very conventional novels, but I kind of grew up on reading Joyce, Kafka, and William Burroughs and people like that. I mean, for me, that's kind of the tradition. And I think all of those writers, for them, kind of ideas, concepts were very much part of what they were doing. But I wasn't thinking it's going to be post, anti, post, post, anti anything. It's just these were a bunch of concerns that seemed to have a narrative trajectory, and I wrote it down.
There is, I guess, in the International Necronautical Society, because I went on the website, there is something that you're trying to do with that, at least, internet art or performance art of some kind. And I'm curious how those concepts would translate into a novel.
I mean, the way I describe the INS, the International Necronautical Society, is as a fiction, but it's a fiction that's taking place off the page. It's being played out through usually art institutions, but not always. I mean, there are publishing wings of it as well. There's kind of, you know, the chief philosopher heads up the philosophy department at the New School in New York, so there's a kind of academic side. It's a kind of network that's blatantly and not without humor kind of modeled on the avant-gardes of the early 20th century and their committees and subcommittees and denunciations and manifestos and so on. But the type of kind of themes and interests that I've used the INS to play out are the very same ones that found their way into C. And in fact, I had the idea for this novel C when I was setting up an INS project at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London that involved a bunch of radio transmissions. And I was looking at the history of radio, and the novel sprung out of that. So there's a kind of transfer that takes place between these different modes of art world or novel.
There is that feel, for me at least in reading it, that I'm reading a novel that was written 50 years ago or 60 years ago. And it isn't merely because you're trying to stay in terms of the dialogue or the writing style or the wordage used at that particular time in, say, the 30s and 40s. There's a different kind of feel to it. And I'm not quite sure what that is. Is it something you sense as you're writing it?
I see it as a very contemporary novel. Some people describe this as a historical novel because it's set 100 years ago, and I think that's a smokescreen. I think that's a red herring. I mean, it's about media, and it's about empire. And it ends in the Middle East with, you know, the colonial powers lost in the labyrinth of their own projections as oil is being prospected for. I mean, it has blatant parallels with what's going on now. And at the same time, it is a kind of archaeology of modernism. I mean, it ends in 1922, which is the great year of literary modernism. It's the year that Ulysses and The Wasteland are published. This book is kind of excavating that moment. But I didn't want it just to kind of imitate that moment. I mean, I wanted it to be from now, looking at then.
All historical novels, of course, are in some degree set within the time that they're written.
Yeah, same as sci-fi. Yeah. It's not about the future, it's about now.
Looking at this, I mean, I was jotting down notes, trying to put it all into context. I started writing Communication Today, cell phones, Facebook, text, cable, DVD, iPods, earbuds, instant communication. The book itself, the story, begins virtually with the start of the telegraph, moves on to radio, then slowly we branch outward from one small place, which is Versailles, outward to Northern Europe, to Egypt. And I kept noticing that the seance, for instance, is control to control to control. And then he goes to Egypt, Serge goes to Egypt, and we're seeing pole to pole to pole. So we're seeing parallels and expansion from the beginning of the book to the end. Am I catching something there?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
When you're doing that, how much is engineered forward and how much is reversed in the actual writing?
Well, I had the idea for the book. It all kind of came at once. I was thinking about radio, and I was thinking about archaeology as well, and I looked at this biography of Howard Carter and of Lord Carnarvon, two C's, right, who dug up Tutankhamun in 1922, which was not only the great year of modernism, it was also the year that the BBC was founded. So the year that the great anarchic many-to-many network period of radio was kind of quashed and brought under the control of one centralized state broadcaster. But these things kind of went together. So at the moment, as soon as I'd made that kind of overlay of radio technology and archaeology and empire, England loses Egypt in 1922 as well. As soon as those things had come together, the whole novel was kind of there. I mean, the backbone of it. And then, I mean, it took 4 years to write. I had to do loads of research. But the arc was there.
And then when you go back and you begin with Versoix, which is where our hero Serge, S-E-R-G-E, but this is about electricity, so
yeah,
S-U-R-G-E,
right. Yeah.
Makes sense. Versoix. My thought was Versailles, of course, but then there's also French for silkworm.
Silkworm, vers.
And toward hearing as well, and mm-hmm. This is a school for the deaf. So take us through that process. How do you get to the name?
Well, exactly how you're describing it, I wanted it to be something that kind of resonates in five or six ways, that plays on five or six channels. I mean, there's also vers soi, like soi in French is oneself. So towards selfhood, it's not just the becoming of radio, it's the becoming of kind of subjectivity, of identity is kind of being formulated there. This is the way literature works. This is the way the literature that I admire most works. I mean, if you read Ulysses, which I mentioned a minute ago, there is no message there. There's no point in it where the meaning of the book is kind of going to be delivered. But what it is a set of echoes and half-met echoes and modulations and mutations. And you just have to follow the chains around the book. And they never end and beyond the book. And many of the nodes in that kind of network, that linguistic network or symbolic network, they have five or six different possible meanings in them. And I wanted to kind of get that logic going. So I wanted to have overloaded names, overloaded places. Serge is a type of cloth. You know, there's all types of... I wanted everything to kind of be very multiple, very ambivalent.
How much of that is conscious and how much is just serendipitous?
The decision to try and get that kind of system up and running is conscious, but then, you know, you can't pre-plan it all at once. You have to kind of get one node up, so like have this overdetermined name like Versoix, and then you load some other things in like Maestown and Ellery, which are the districts where Versoix is. I mean, I took those names from, they're Arcadian names from Philip Sidney's Arcadia, but kind of mutated. But then, you know, lydium and lithium and, you know, I mean, which are in radio sets, you know, these things kind of, you find other terms that sound like the first terms and you build up on that, and before too long you've got a whole network up and running. But you don't really control it. It's like a pinball machine, right? You want to get as many balls up hitting the buffers and sending those mushrooms flashing and stuff, but you couldn't anticipate exactly what routes they'll take. You just hope something good happens.
So I pronounce it Versoix, which is fine because it brings us to Versailles, but then Versoix brings it somewhere else as well.
Yeah.
Serge, our protagonist, his sister is Sophie, and as I'm finished reading the book, I'm going, thinking back, and I go, Sophie, Sophia, wisdom.
Wisdom, yep. Well, I mean, Sophia, and again, I didn't find this out till, I mean, I knew Sophie meant wisdom, but then it turns out there is a figure who was prominent in Alexandrian early Christianity, Sophia, who was meant to be the syzygy of Christ, wisdom of the Gnostics, who falls into matter and the whole universe is formed of her agony and remorse, and all the novel ends in Egypt, and all the kind of poets associated with, or writers associated with Alexandria, like Cavafy and Ian Forster and even Lawrence Durrell, kind of write about her quite a bit. Yeah, that's an example of something coming up later that echoed something that was already set up there, and I jump on these things and try and amplify them, get as much reverb and feedback going as possible.
Well, as you're writing then, it seems that the serendipitous would just at one point or other take over, and then you could just go with that.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you ever see Sonic Youth or someone playing live, they put their guitars right up against the speakers in order to get as much feedback and distortion going. It's deliberate. And I was kind of trying to use that same logic in the writing. I mean, just push things so close to one another that a third sound or whatever channel comes out.
Let's go back to the origins of the story, which is our character, Serge. His father is based on information you got about Alexander Graham Bell and also a case study by Freud.
Yeah, Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone, his father ran a school for the deaf, and he was an oralist. He was into forcing deaf people to speak and completely prohibiting sign language. So that's kind of interesting. You know, you've got official language, then a secret underground channel going on of prohibited silent language. And Alexander Bell's father would force these kids that he was teaching to speak. He'd make them recite poetry, and I thought that was really interesting. And his mother was deaf, and Alex's wife was deaf, and he also lost two siblings, and then he invented the telephone. So all these kind of histories are kind of embedded in the technology itself by the time it comes to be invented. So that was one kind of influence. And then you mentioned Freud's case history of the Wolfman, which for me is like stands as some of the best gothic fiction. I mean, it's about this guy who grows up on a wealthy country estate. His sister dies, he has a semi-incestuous relationship with her, and then the rest of his life is a kind of protracted and deferred act of mourning or of melancholia, and all these neuroses form within him that are kind of very creative in a way.
You talk elsewhere about reusing material, recycling material. So how much of the material at the beginning of the book is recycled directly from Bell? You've got the school for the deaf.
Yeah.
You've got an entire performance which seems to mirror the performances that were given at Bell's father's school.
Kind of, yeah. But also in Sydney's Arcadia, they have these things called eclogues, which is where the shepherds, who are the main population of this kingdom, they perform narratives which kind of in a coded way criticize and reflect the life of the court, kind of like what Shakespeare did, you know. And I thought that was really interesting, these annual ritualized performances. You also get it in Virginia Woolf's novel Between the Acts, which the whole of the novel is a play set just on the verge of World War II, but there's a similar kind of amateur dramatics side to it. So yeah, in a way I was kind of pulling all these things and trying to overlay them like so many sheets of acetate, hopefully to produce something new. I'm not interested just in imitating.
What comes to mind is sampling.
Yeah, it's very like sampling, yeah. You know, Ezra Pound said, bad writers imitate good writers still, but I figure, like, if you're plagiarizing five things at once, it's not plagiarism anymore, right? I mean, if you're stealing five things and mixing them, then you are creating something new, just like Eliot was or something.
Well, you're also doing something else throughout the entire book, which is trying to recreate the minutiae of life during that period, which in a weird way parallels Remainders, where a guy is trying to recreate his life.
Yeah, it's this idea of kind of exactly of reconstruction or how to narrate the event. I mean, this is the kind of conceptual impossibility at the core of Remainder, which involves this guy elaborately spending, you know, millions of pounds to hire people to reconstruct events that he vaguely remembered, and they never get it right because you can't. And I suppose this is, in a way, it's almost like a metaphor for all of narrative. You know, the impossibility of actually narrating the event. There's a scene in C where Serge goes up in the air in World War One, and he's in this elaborate battle with all this trajectories of ordnance and radio signals and death going on around him. And then when he lands, he has to, and this is true, I found out from my research, they immediately have to give a narrative. They call it the flight narrative, and they have to say, we did this, this, and this. And the recording officer is saying to him, give your narrative. I need the narrative. And he just goes, we went up. We saw stuff, it was good. Because in a way, it's so inadequate. Anything he'd say would be inadequate to kind of capture that phenomenological kind of moment that he may as well just say something totally flippant.
The scenes in World War One are incredibly detailed. Some of the stuff I knew nothing about, the balloons over Germany. How did you find out about that?
Well, I live in London, so, you know, I'm lucky to have the Imperial War Museum virtually on my, well, you know, just across the river. And I spent a good month. They have a beautiful archive, which is up in the dome. You're up, it's like the dome of St. Paul's. You're sitting in this incredible dome building reading. And they let you have the actual documents. I mean, I was handling these flight narratives that were crumbling in my hands and looking at pilots' notebooks and their instructions of how to fly. And
all the stuff that you mentioned about, you know, kite balloons, observation balloons that would hover above the trenches. But I was also reading a lot of Marinetti and the Futurists, these Italian artists and writers who did fight in World War One and who loved it. And they saw war as part of a general blossoming of through technology of a new aesthetic era, that life, you know, the world becomes geometry and death. They're very problematic figures. Half of them were total card-carrying fascists. But there is a real kind of exuberance and exhilaration in their writing that I wanted to examine as well.
And when you're talking about the geometry, suddenly we got the idea that Serge can only see things flat.
Yes, this idea of flatness is quite interested in it. I mean, Freud talks about screen memories, that it's as though for Freud the neurotic has a screen and different traumas get projected onto it and become this new kind of collage of memory which is never authentic. But I like the idea of the flatness, and of course during this period cinema is emerging.
Right.
You know, and modernism is in the visual arts is questioning, you know, ideas inherited from the Renaissance about perspective and so on. And it ends in Egypt as well. The flatness of hieroglyphics is kind of interesting. You know, that it's narrative, but it has no depth. I don't know. You know, I'm really into Warhol. You know, he was into flatness, everything just being flat, a screen. I like that.
What I was getting from Serge is that if Serge sees the world as flat and the rest of us see it as round, then that itself is lending a different sense to who he is. There's a scene early on in the book where he's being taught perspective, and he doesn't get it.
He just can't do it. He sees things flat. He paints things flat. So in a way, when he's above the battlefields in the war, I mean, this is, he loves it because the world is properly flat again. Everything is just, he describes it as running out, the landscape runs out from beneath his tail like a ticker tape, because he faces backwards like a ticker tape or a strip of film, which is again kind of a bit like hieroglyphic strips. This is the way he kind of likes to read it. Yeah.
Well, what's odd is, or maybe this is intentional, is that he's seeing the world in two dimensions, but radio is by its very nature three-dimensional.
Yes, radio kind of billows around through space and bounces back. But at the same time, I mean, it's kind of like a set of inscriptions made on the air. And there's a scene where his father is saying to him, nothing ever goes away. Once the negative has been scratched, that scratch is there forever. He doesn't use exactly that metaphor, but he may as well. You know, that scratch is there forever. You know, we're still hearing echoes of Marconi's first S bounced across the Atlantic. He's right. There are aliens listening to 1930s radio shows as we speak.
Tom McCarthy, there's only around five or six different set scenes, so we can almost go one to the other. The set scene between Versailles or Versoix and World War One takes place on the eve of World War One in a spa in Germany.
Middle Europe.
What I was getting throughout the entire sequence was the portents of war, that it was kind of a miasma hanging over Serge's own miasma. How conscious was that element?
Oh, it was very deliberate. I mean, for a start, that sequence is a huge tribute to Thomas Mann, I mean, to the Magic Mountain, which takes place on the eve of war in a spa. It's a tuberculosis spa. My one's a kind of digestive tract spa. But the thing is with Serge, when his sister dies, and this is straight from Freud, this is what the Wolfman has as well, he cannot experience the kind of requisite emotion that society expects of him. He cannot sentimentalize that trauma. He feels a deadening, an emotional deadening. And this is what happens to Serge. And in a way, I didn't want the whole process of grief to play out in him. I wanted the world to become the site on which it's played out. It's displaced from him into the world and into history. So the world becomes his psychic space in war. It's like an extension of him. It's traumatized, it's screwed up, disconnected from itself. Yeah, kind of brewing in that Middle European section, and everything is blocked. He's got a blockage in his intestines. Mela Chole, from which the term melancholia comes, it literally means black bile, and it was thought, you know, up until the late mid-19th century, that that was the problem. If you were melancholic or depressed, it was because you had an excess of black bile, black matter inside you.
Tom McCarthy, after that, we come to an interesting sequence which plays into this, which is the search for a life beyond death. And, of course, there the radio becomes the medium, and, of course, it's a false medium. What struck me about that sequence is that in all of the other sequences, from beginning to end, things happen through Serge. He's, I don't want to say he's passive because he goes out after women, but he lets things happen to him.
He's like the receiver.
This is the only sequence in the book where he is not a receiver and he is active.
Yes, this is a very good point, and it's true, and I hadn't thought of it like that, but you're absolutely right. I mean, he goes to a seance and he witnesses what seems to be accurate reception by someone else, by the medium, who incidentally uses all the vocabulary of radio. I'm tuning in, I'm getting resonations, I'm getting vibra, you know. But he seems to witness somebody else receiving, and because he has got an ammeter secreted in his pocket, a device for measuring jumps in electricity, and he notices its needle jumping, he realizes that the reason the table is tilting is because somebody is remote controlling it, like we remote control our TVs. This was done at that time. The technology was there. So he does kind of pick up. So he's the third place in the triangle, and then he builds a better remote controller, and he jumps the signal and makes the table spell obscene messages, and actually it makes it denounce the medium, saying, I am a fraud, and it's radio controlled.
The sequence sits in the novel as almost a comic interlude,
yeah,
which almost cuts through the rest of the book. Suddenly that miasma is lifted.
Yeah, but at the same time, there's a kind of sleight of hand taking place there, because Serge reveals the seance to be a fraud. This table has been tilting, and the angry crowd rush, you know, that the medium escapes through about back door, and the crowd attack the table itself as though it had tricked them, which it has, and they snap it in two, and there you can see the radio mechanism, and then Serge looks closely, and a little bit of black bile comes out. It turns out to be a woodlouse, but it you know, this black kind of oil-like drip. And also his sister was obsessed with insects. So it is a kind of return of the dead and return of the black matter, you know, but a material return. It's a material remainder. It's a totally materialist book, that there are ghosts, but there are material ghosts. The dead do come back, but there's nothing to do with spirits or anything abstract. It's about material processes.
Now, Tom McCarthy, the final section of the book goes forward to 1922 and takes place in Egypt, but from a dispassionate look at a person, a world, it turns political and anti-imperialist.
Yeah, I mean, it shows the end of empire. Britain loses Egypt in 1922, just as they're constructing pylons for the Empire Wireless Chain. I didn't make this up. This is right. This is true. Turns out the word pylon comes from ancient Egypt, and it means a temple, a passageway to the underworld. So in a way, these pylons are already mourning on memorials on a national scale for some loss, which is empire. And yes, I mean, in the book, you see it all breaking up. You see all the spies kind of gathering information, but they're just completely lost in it. It becomes this kind of labyrinth that they don't know what's real and what's not. I mean, it seemed to me there's very obvious parallels with the present day in the Middle East. I mean, I don't know if it takes a position for or against. It just looks at that end of empire. I mean, I don't know if it's an anti-imperialist book.
The European characters, their comments about it pretty much are very, very unconscious about what's really going on. And we could see what's really going on because it's going on around them. And if they weren't, you've certainly pushed the envelope by forcing Serge into a tomb where everything is falling on top
yes,
of him.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, the final passages, he's having these enormous deliriums and has visions of the compound and the natives coming towards it and the walls are breached. I guess there's a kind of parallel between the self and the imperial construct, that both of these have been ruptured and are bleeding and are kind of disintegrating.
And therefore, Serge can't go much beyond this, I guess, without some kind of transcendence, which he can't get.
Which he can't get. No, at the end, he just becomes pure signal. He gives himself over to static, and he becomes carbon, C. You know, he becomes the carbon paper, out of which the novel is written. I mean, the CC'd, carbon copied. In a way, we're almost literally reading his body, you know, by the end of the book, the black ink.
When you're doing the research, getting back to more practical matters, how do you know when you've got enough? How do you know when there's too much? What do you do?
There's a lot to be found out. I mean, you get into the Imperial War Museum and it's fascinating stuff, and you spend a week and then another week, and of course you could spend a lifetime. And it's the same, you know, in the British Museum. I started reading the Egyptian stuff and then reading stuff about, you know, the Imperial wireless chain and expatriate life in Alexandria. And again, you could go on for a decade and not write anything. I think there just comes a point where you just know you've got enough. My concern in this book wasn't to give an accurate depiction of an era, even right. if it does as a side effect. Everything in there had to play a symbolic role and echo something else, like it's a kind of symphony. Everything had to be a note that corresponded to another note or took a kind of theme and developed it. And you just know when you've got enough, like a pilot knows when there's enough speed to kind of take off. You could carry on accelerating way off the runway, but there's a point, you know, critical speed where you just feel, now I write, you know.
It seemed to me that in the end, what I kept coming back to was the silk. And I'm not sure why, except that then you've got the resonance of scarabs at the end. But then what is silk and how is it created? Halfway through the book, we discover that the trees are dead and the silk can't be made anymore.
Yeah, there's a blight. There's a blight on the trees.
And is that historical?
It happens every so often. Okay. I mean, trees get dieback. I love that word, dieback. You know, dying back. it's the return of the repressed. In a way, the whole book is about what Freud called the return of the repressed, whether that's the unmourned sibling or the inevitable end of empire or just matter coming back and upsetting all our concepts. Yeah, dying back.
But I guess the point I'm making is that the resonances from the beginning of the book are reflected toward the end of the book, and we might even see resonances that you don't see, as Joyce certainly did.
Yeah. No, I definitely wanted... I mean, it begins with someone, a doctor, going into a family estate, saying it's silent as a tomb, you know, and it ends, you know, firstly with a tomb and then with a doctor coming in to attend the dying subject. I mean, it's completely kind of one end mirrors the other. And you're right, this theme of silk... and of veils, and of, I mean, Serge is born with a caul on his head, which is a kind of silken hood that it's very rare, but it's like one in every 50,000 babies or something has a caul. And there are endless, you know, when he's in the war, his parachutes over his face, and then, you know, later he's got this kind of furred vision, and at the very end there's these images where he, in his delirium, like Lord Jim, he has a kind of delirious wedding with a imaginary bride, and he lifts her veil, and of course it's kind of his sister. So, yeah, these images keep coming back, and silk is totally central, yeah.
There's a quote from The Guardian, I think it's from The Guardian, where you say, most modern commercial middlebrow authors have become aligned with mainstream culture and its underlying aesthetic of self-expression. And I was reading that, and I kept coming back to that last phrase, its underlying aesthetic of self-expression.
I think, you know, the dominant, we could almost call it an ideology. I mean, the main kind of story we're given in this society is, you know, you are a unique individual, express yourself. You know, this is the logic of consumer culture, buy these shoes to express yourself, buy our products to express yourself. This idea that there is a self who is absolute, and then that self expresses itself, and this is what kind of cultural iterations are, be they novels, films, whatever. I reject this. You know, I think it's not an interesting way to think about what culture is or what art is. I mean, what interests me is that there is no self before society, before language, before technology. There are networks, and out of those networks comes the possibility of kind of chimeras of identity, you know, different types of identity. But that identity will always be networked, always ruptured, always kind of interrupted. And I think that's what novelists and artists should kind of be taking on board, not least because it resists the dominant kind of ideology of our society. If you look at David Lynch's films, I mean, they're brilliant. There are no complete subjects there. They're always interrupted. They're always split. They're always, you know, at the other end of a telephone call or a video camera. They're always somewhere else. And I love that. First is the network.
What was fascinating is when I learned that, you know, you were a huge Lynch fan, not too long ago I interviewed a writer and critic named Eddie Muller who focuses on noir, and I had asked him what contemporary work was noir, And, of course, most noir, as we know it now, is this post-neo-noir, which is barely noir at all. It's just commenting on itself, and it's dull. He mentioned two films, and specifically, one is Mulholland Drive, the other is Memento, and I can see both films, both Mulholland Drive and Memento, coming right back to what you're talking about.
Yeah. Lynch is a huge influence. You know, he seems to really understand the kind of multiple makeup of our identities, how we're not unified, absolute selves. You know, we're combinations of a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, be these the narratives of Hollywood that are so ingrained in us, or the telephone system.
Well, Memento, of going backward where a person's memory disappears each time. Yeah.
That's what happens in Remainder. I mean, and he has to keep, yeah, Memento has to keep reasserting it. And
that reminds me also of the nature of what art is. I mean, recently we discovered that Joaquin Phoenix never went insane. In fact, his entire act for 2 years quitting acting was just an act created for a multidimensional work of art.
I think that's good. I think people should be suspicious of everything, you know, not just of what they're being told in a movie, but of what they're being told on the news as well. I mean, everything is kind of, I don't like this distinction between fiction and the real. I mean, you know, the real is so suffused with fiction, and fiction is so suffused with the real, it's kind of difficult to separate them. J.G. Ballard, in his introduction to Crash, his novel from 73, he writes that we're surrounded by fictions, sexual choices, lifestyle fantasies, personae, that if we have enough money, we can kind of act out. He says the fiction is everywhere, and the writer's task is to invent the reality, not to represent it, but to produce it. I think that's great. I think that's really true and something we should not lose sight of.
The Guardian also makes this comment about the book C, and I'm just curious whether, first of all, you agree with it, and secondly, how it fits into your philosophy, which almost sounds like a metapolitical philosophy. They describe the book as a 1960s-style anti-novel, fundamentally hostile to the notion of character, and dramatizes or encodes a set of ideas concerning subjectivity.
Yeah, I think that's lazy, what that guy wrote. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, avant-garde and experimental can be used as terms just to kind of sideline a type of writing that's not mainstream and sentimental. I mean, if C is an anti-novel, right, then Ulysses must be, by that measure, 10 times an anti-novel, and Tristram Shandy, and Don Quixote, and frankly, every significant novel in literary history. So if all of those are anti-novels, then, like, what are we left with? What's a novel? And so, I mean, I think any interesting novel or work of art in any medium is conducting some kind of experiment. It's trying to feel and negotiate the boundaries of its own form and maybe kind of undermine them a bit. Otherwise, it's just genre, it's just entertainment. But I don't know if, I mean, at 60s-style anti-novel, I just don't, you know, I think it's a 2010-style novel.
The other book that's the book of the moment is the new Jonathan Franzen book, and as if somehow C is the anti-freedom, and I don't see that at all. I see two people coming at fiction in two different ways, each getting into our psyche, but not using the same way to do it.
Yeah, I haven't read the Franzen book yet, so I can't comment directly on it. But what you say makes sense. There are many ways to skin a cat, eh?
Let's get back a little bit to your own life, Harm McCarthy. You say you didn't read a lot of the standard works. What was your focus? Was it philosophy rather than?
No, it was literature. I mean, I read that as well. Some journalists write, oh, he ignores contemporary fiction because I haven't read, you know, the latest Ian McEwan. I mean, I read a lot of contemporary fiction. I've read everything ever written by Jean-Philippe Toussaint and figures like Ben Marcus, Shelley Jackson, Jonathan Lethem. I mean, you know, I'm reading a lot of contemporary work. I'm just perhaps reading stuff that's slightly different than what the journalists that write that kind of stuff are reading and seem to want everyone else to be reading. You know, my first love has always been literature, but philosophy is kind of important. And most of the literature that I really admire has been very concerned with philosophy. This is true of Lawrence Sterne and of Shakespeare, let alone of Joyce, you know, who spent ages reading everyone from Thomas Aquinas to, you know, and Beckett's reading Heidegger. And I mean, these boundaries between these two things are quite fluid. You know, if it's a figure like Derrida, who I really admire, you know, half of what he writes, a portion of it is in the mode of fiction. It has fictional voices and, you know, narrative situations.
Tom McCarthy, did you always plan on being a writer?
I always wanted to be a writer. I kind of grew up on stories. You know, my mum is a classicist, and she'd tell us the Odyssey in the car, you know, to stop us fighting, me and my brother and sister, or whatever, you know, the Merchant of Venice or something. But I always understood from a young age, I mean, not only is this a great story and I love it, but there's this guy called Shakespeare or, you know, Homer, who writes this, and I thought that's the thing to be. I like that idea of, you know, you get a typewriter and then you write it. So you don't even have to be the first one to write it. You know, Macbeth had been written before Shakespeare wrote it, and when he found a good line in the older version, he kept it, you know, the sampling thing you mentioned earlier. I always wanted to be a writer, but I always understood that that had an element of reenactment and repetition in it.
And the gap between college and remainder? Were you writing at the time?
Yeah, I was. You know, after college, I moved to Prague in the early 90s because it was a very cheap place and it seemed to be the place to be. And then I was in Berlin for a while and Amsterdam and, you know, wherever the rent was cheap. And, you know, there's a congregation of young artists and writers all kind of exchanging ideas and fluids. So I just wrote and partied and wrote and, you know, did what that kind of what you do in your 20s thing, a long apprenticeship.
Were there a lot of false starts before remainder?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's piles and boxes full of junk and juvenilia. You know, it's like burn money in a startup. I mean, you need to write the first few hundred thousand words before it gets anywhere near good.
What's Tintin and the Secret of Literature?
Ever since I was a child, I've had a long-standing admiration for the work of the Belgian cartoonist Hergé, the Tintin books. These are not so well known in America, but Spielberg's is about to make a huge film, which is going to be dreadful, but he's going to... Well, please prove me wrong. But anyhow, and then they'll be much better known. But what's interesting about the Tintin cartoons, there's 23 books, but if you read them in one after the other in the correct sequence, it's one big... kind of arcing narrative. Hergé liked to call it his comedy humaine after Balzac, all of whose novels kind of make one big novel. It's for kids, but it's very classical. Same as Sophocles or Shakespeare, it's always about the great family house and the secrets this contains and the host-guest relationship gone wrong and upheavals in the world. And it's brilliant. It's very subtle. And anyhow, so I wrote a book considering whether it's literature, because it's in this kind of popular format, you know, is that the same as literature? Is it different? And I was looking at, I was really a way of looking at what is literature, this perennial question that everyone from, you know, Sartre to Roland Barthes to Plato kind of gets twisted and perplexed about. And I wanted to kind of use the Tintin books as a way of looking at that.
Do you think bad art is too sentimental?
Often, yes. Having said that, you know, you get perfectly bad avant-garde art as well. I mean, you know, that's not sentimental. I mean, this is the question. You know, you've got the avant-garde. It happened in the early 20th century. You've got modernism. It was a huge upheaval, and it's very important. We can't turn our back on it. At the same time, the worst thing that we could do to the avant-garde would be to turn it into a genre. Right? So if I just randomly cut text together and then say this is radical, well, no, it's not. It's no more radical than a romantic comedy screenplay in Hollywood. I mean, I think good art, it's not about the format it's in. You know, I love 19th century novels as much as kind of more modernist ones. I mean, it's about something more profound. So, yeah, the kind of challenge for art is to be good, not to be a particular way.
Tom McCarthy, you working on another book yet?
Yeah, I've just begun. It hasn't really taken shape yet, but in a way it kind of takes off from where C ends. I mean, C ends with someone sweating black ink sweat into this oily sea, which becomes like vinyl, this kind of record of all pasts. And I think Saturn Island's going to begin with that. I was really interested in oil spills, actually, and the kind of way that, you know, when oil hardens, it becomes like vinyl. And I was looking a lot at oil spills. This is about kind of 9 months ago. And then the whole Louisiana thing happened, and that was, you know, kind of made it a bit less abstract. And, you know, I'm not quite sure what to do with that material now. But it's finding its shape very, very slowly. But it will be called Saturn Island, I think, eventually.
You've been listening to an interview with Tom McCarthy, whose latest novel is Sea, which is a finalist for the Booker Prize. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.